Happy New Year from everyone at Spectrum West, the program that is coming on right now. Hi, everybody. I'm Al Ross, and welcome to Western Wisconsin's look at music and the arts, humanities, so prevalent right in our own backyard. Today, you're going to meet the new Wisconsin Poet Laureate from the UW-Eau Claire English Department, Max Garland. He stopped by yesterday, the day of the announcement of his honor. We'll get to know him and find out how to access his wonderful body of work. Jim Oliver starts his new year of spectrumming. That's a new word. I just coined it. It's a verb. You can spectrum now. By sharing a conversation he enjoyed with Beth Reidenbach, director of the FIP Center for the Arts, production of The Rainmaker, opening next Friday. We're also going to dig into the art of antiques appraisal with a gentleman who's a regular authority on Antiques Roadshow and who's coming to the L.E. Phillips Public Library in Eau Claire next Saturday to look at what you bring in for evaluation. His name is Mark Moran. But before all that, guess what? It's time again for the Eau Claire Ragtime Festival, 14th year. And as usual, those at the helm have 3 days full of activity planned for you. Mr. Jim Radloff is back with a glance at what the 2013 event has to offer. First, how's the hand doing?
The hand is doing as well as can be expected.
Now, a lot of people who don't know Jim Radloff should know that he's a piano player, and last year, he reached into a snowblower when something was still turning. And now his right hand has some abbreviated digits.
Three in the middle are retired from performing. So the thumb and the little finger have picked up the slack, and I found I could continue to play, and I have been doing so within 10 days after the accident.
Thanks for the update.
Thank you, Al.
If you count them since it started in the year 2000, this is the 14th year of the festival.
That's correct.
This year your beneficiary is the Feed My People Food Bank. Let's talk about the festival as it has gone from the year. How was it the first year? What did you learn after the first year?
Well, we learned that people wanted to hear more. Some people wanted to have a daytime concert. They didn't care to drive so much at night. People wanted food. They wanted sing-alongs. A lot of these ideas were incorporated, and the festival grew. But that first year was simply one concert, and we had no tickets. People just paid 10 bucks at the door and came in. Community Table was the beneficiary, and when we turned over $1,850 to them, they said, this is the biggest fundraiser we've ever had.
Cool.
Of course, we had to do it again.
So that answers my question, which was, have you always had a beneficiary? So if you had it the first year, it's obvious you've had one every year.
Yes. In fact, it's morphed into a cycle of five local nonprofits that benefit. And as you said, this year coming, it's Feed My People.
The other thing that's really neat about this festival is that in addition to all the playing and the performing and the hoopla, there is an educational aspect.
We have always offered to the schools in the region free performances, educational and entertaining, for their students the day before the festival starts and the morning of the festival. And we've done as many as 12 schools. Over the years, we've done over 100. That's touched a lot of students over the years.
Have you yourself been able to attend any of those? The reason I'm looking for a first-person description of what it's like to watch kids listen to ragtime music, because it's not in their realm, normally.
It is not. The programs are geared to tying in the history of what was to what they hear now, and how it's related through ragtime, early jazz, Dixieland, big bands, rock and roll, and on and on.
Okay.
So, and I've been in a number of those programs, and I've transported some of our artists to schools, and I've watched. And the faculty at the schools and any parents that happen to be there, they can't believe it. They can't believe it.
I wonder how many kids who play piano go home and say, can you get me some ragtime sheet music? Because I want to learn that.
Funny you should mention that, because on the eve of the opening day of the festival, which is Friday the 11th.
Yeah.
On Thursday the 10th at 6:30, there is a free youth ragtime concert, and they will have, through the Chippewa Valley Music Teachers, approximately 20 young people playing ragtime music.
Wow.
It has caught on.
Huh. Neat.
Yeah.
Our old buddy Jim Radloff is here. We are talking the Eau Claire Ragtime Festival. It is next weekend. It's January 11th through 13th. The main venue, although there are others, is the First Congregational Church. All right, Jim, time to tell us about this year's headliners.
We've got three acts. We've got Ivory and Gold, Jeff and Ann Barnhart from Connecticut. They are world famous, travel a lot out of the country. Jeff on piano and Ann on flute. And if you've never heard or wonder what it would sound like to hear ragtime flute, this is your big opportunity without leaving the region here.
I mean, ragtime flute.
And then we have Marty Mincer. Marty Mincer is from Western Iowa, an accomplished ragtime pianist. He has won all the prizes you can at the World Championship old-time piano playing contest in Illinois over the years. And in another life, he's an apple farmer and over-the-road truck driver. So this affects everybody.
Yeah. And you are saving the hardest pronunciation for last, aren't you?
The hardest pronunciation, if you leave out a couple of letters, is Larissa Migashov. Larissa was born and raised in Russia. Classically trained and gave that up when the family moved to the United States.
Mm-hmm.
She writes contemporary ragtime songs, all of which are titled after some food, and we will be introducing the Cheesehead Rag that she dedicated to the Ragtime Festival here.
Cool.
I'm currently working on the lyrics to that, which she did not do. But in her other life, she is a patent attorney in Northern California. So we've got people from the East Coast, the West Coast, and in between that people can find out about by going to our website, which is ecragtime.org. They can get a lot of information there. There are links to the sites that our featured performers have. And I have to mention, Al, there are, in addition to these featured acts, another 15 to 20 performers like myself or like others that have been featured in previous years that will be performing in pre-concerts. So if people come to a concert, get there at least a half hour early,
sure,
because that's when the music starts.
And you don't have to go hungry, I see.
No. We have the Jonah Group at First Congregational Church, which is the venue here in Eau Claire. We'll be serving the meal on Friday evening.
Mm.
The youth will have the concessions and the meal on Saturday. And the Ragtime Society will have the catered by Yankee Jacks buffet and bash on Sunday following the ragtime service at the church.
Is ragtime an international phenomenon? I mean, I realize it was born in America.
Born in America.
A long time ago.
You got that. And exported here, unlike all other music forms. It's a blend of the classical European structure, if you will, and the West African rhythms. But I know there are ragtime groups in Switzerland and in Norway and in Hungary and in Latin America.
I'm guessing that maybe the Latin Americans add a certain little something to the ragtime music.
There is a Latin component to a lot of it, and you'll hear some of that. One of our non-featured performers is a fellow by the name of Galen Parker. It comes from Rochester, New York every year, and he plays Latin style ragtime.
Kind of a salsa type.
Yeah, there's definitely that to it. The Cuban Caribbean influence. The host hotel and adjacent restaurant and bar is the Holiday Inn here in Eau Claire, Holiday Inn Campus. We'll have a piano in for the festival. And there'll be a lot of what we call late night. It's after 11 o'clock.
that is late.
That is pretty late.
Doesn't sound late to some people, but
that's late
to me.
But a lot of fun. That goes on for several days.
That's the voice of Jim Radloff. We are talking about the Eau Claire Ragtime Festival. It happens next weekend. I also see there's a twin piano lounge. Where's that?
That's what we call our chapel. It's connected to the sanctuary at the First Congregational Church on Broadway Street in Eau Claire. And we have two pianos. So calling it a chapel for that weekend just didn't seem
right.
That's open piano, and many of these other players, including myself at times, are assigned 20-minute sets when a concert isn't going on. So there's always live music.
Okay, one more time, the contact information and how people can get tickets.
ecragtime.org is the quickest contact. You can download a form there, or the number is there. You can call the church office. Or you can walk in. I would suggest for the Friday, Saturday, Sunday meals that tickets be bought in advance.
Well, thanks for coming, Jim, and good luck with this year's festival. I know you don't need it. But
thank you very much for having us again, Al. Appreciate it.
Support for WPR comes from Wisconsin Credit Union, announcing a new location in Eau Claire at the corner of Claremont Avenue and Craig Road. Complete information, including membership and loan applications, is at wisconsincu.org. Support also comes from Festival Foods, dedicated to making every business decision based on the premise of bringing customers back. More about Festival Foods' boomerang theory at festivalfoods.com.
Spectrum West at 5:18 on the 4th of January, 2013. Today is the opening of a student art exhibit from 7:30 to 9 p.m. at the Northern Lakes Center for the Arts. That's in Amory. The exhibit will hang through the month of January. Tomorrow it's a writer's forum, an evening of original stories, poems, and essays read by authors as published in Soundings. Starting time 7:30 at the center in Amory. Information at 268-6811. Well, the state's poet laureate had been part of the governor's office. It was created by executive order of Republican Governor Tommy Thompson in 2000. Since then, the state has had four poets laureate. As with many things being handled by the current administration in Wisconsin, funding for the arts has endured the paring knife. Not content to merely reduce funding and state aid to the arts by 73%, on February 4, 2011, the Wisconsin Poet Laureate Commission received a form letter from the office of Governor Walker indicating the commission would be abolished. In May 2011, the Wisconsin Academy of Sciences, Arts, and Letters announced it would steward the Wisconsin Poet Laureate program to ensure its survival. Yesterday, the Academy announced the name of Wisconsin's fifth Poet Laureate, and Western Wisconsin is proud to have Eau Claire resident and UW-Eau Claire English professor Max Garland manning that position for the next 2 years. The Poet Laureate is required to choose and lead one project that will contribute to the growth of poetry in this state, plan and attend at least four statewide literary events each year, and perform in at least four government, state, and civic events as requested by the governor's office, school systems, and literary organizations. We were fortunate to welcome Max Garland to our WPR studio yesterday, the day of his announced honor. Well, congratulations on the Poet Laureate honor, I think. I say that because I read the former Poet Laureate had 140 appearances last year.
Well, I didn't know that. Now I feel forewarned.
Yeah, well, you know, it's an honor tempered with realities,
well, thank
I guess.
You. Yes, I'll keep that in mind.
Tell me about this former rural letter carrier thing that I read about. That's pretty neat, and it seemed to be a foundation.
The first book of mine was called The Postal Confessions, and it did draw from my experience almost 10 years running a rural mail route. On the route my grandfather ran, the route on which I was born, my parents lived, my grandparents, aunts and uncles. And for a long, long time, I wrote poems, I delivered mail. That was the way I thought a writer was supposed to live.
Cool. Grew up in Kentucky. So I'm wondering, does where one is raised influence how one writes or what one writes?
I would say most of the time that would be true.
Yeah.
It would be particularly if you grew up in a rural area, if you grew up with intimate contact with the natural world, if you grew up in an urban setting, those experiences might transplant themselves to different parts of the country, but I certainly think anyone who was growing up as a writer who did not pay attention to his or her surroundings would have a problem, really.
You established an interest in what you do as the letter carrier. Was there a little pilot light burning, do you think, prior to that when you were just a kid? Did you like to write at that time?
I would have never imagined that I would become a writer. As a matter of fact, as a kid, I didn't think there were writers, particularly poets. I didn't know. I thought poets were these antique beings who lived back in perhaps ancient Greece. I thought of them more like statues than human beings. And I thought you studied them as a part of the equipment of becoming an educated person. But I didn't know that you could actually be one at the time as a child. I think I was becoming interested in being a writer. I just didn't know it at the time. I didn't know there was such a thing.
They say that good comics, the best comics, are those who have suffered a little bit. What kind of prerequisites like that are necessary to be a good poet, do you think?
That's very interesting. I think that might be true of comics. But I don't think there's a way to avoid suffering. I think in my not-so-extensive study of religions of this world, it seems like one thing they have in common is they center upon that reality of suffering. So I don't think that comics or poets or musicians or artists necessarily suffer any more than other people. They often have a platform for articulating that suffering, but I don't think your average poet suffers any more than your average truck driver or welder, although he may complain about it more.
One of the things I like about poets is that they blow the dust off words that we haven't used in quite a long time. And I keep running across the word wistful.
Wistful.
You know, and wistfulness. So that begs the question, does a person have to feel something in order to write a good poem?
Well, that's also a very good question. Almost any definition you would find of poetry, the word emotion would be in there somewhere. There would be language something like the conveying of experiences, ideas, and emotions. And right at the center of poetry, and one of the things that often differentiates poetry from other forms of communication, business communication, for instance, is that emotion is really at the center of it. It's not on the periphery, but it's at the very center of it. And it would be hard to think of a good writer, artist, or think about a musician, for instance, who did not feel things and did not try or feel a need to convey that feeling into his or her art.
Because most writers that I've talked to, and musicians as well, they admit that just like anything else, just like athletics, it's something that you have to practice, and you should do it every day.
That's true.
So you don't really have to muster volumes of emotion in order to write something every day, but maybe the ones that are founded on emotion are the best.
That could be the case. And what you just mentioned is, I think, particularly true of writing, and particularly true of things that aren't necessarily supported in a sort of wholesale, full and powerful way by the culture necessarily. You have to rely upon the habit that you formed. I wrote this morning. It wasn't very good. I hope no one ever sees it. I did yesterday morning and the morning before that. And you have to, in some ways, not take yourself too seriously. But if you want to be a writer or a musician or artist of any kind or craftsman, make wonderful furniture, you have to at least take that craft seriously. And you have to treat it as seriously as someone who wants to play violin or be a dancer. You can't just turn it on 3 or 4 months in the future. You have to be working at it as you go.
Do you think the words flow more freely when they're based on sadness or when they're based on cheerfulness?
That's a good question. I know that it's easier to write about sadness. If you talk to any 14-year-old who's writing poetry, he or she will say, I write when I'm depressed, I write when I'm sad. And I think it does lend itself. Perhaps it's just as simple as we need an outlet. We need something to do with this sadness rather than just cram it all inside or bore everyone else with it. And art is one of the things that people have used to cope with human suffering and sadness. Now, having said that, there is a long tradition of celebratory poetry. There are psalms and hymns and poems like that, but I think, personally, they're harder to write with a straight face.
Max Garland, he is the brand new Wisconsin Poet Laureate, also UW Eau Claire Professor of English. going back just a little bit, we were talking about suffering and wistfulness. You know, I asked the question, do you have to feel something in order to write a poem? Now, as I wrote that question, I also had the word effective in there. Do you have to feel something in order to write an effective poem? And then I wondered whether or not a poem even need be effective to be good.
Effective, that's interesting. Effective has, in its meaning, some connection with the result, how another person responds to it in some sense. And I suppose that is something of a personal thing. As I said before, people can't avoid suffering. And so everyone feels. People feel when they wake up. They feel when their children take off for school. They feel when they are angry. And it's not as if writers or poets make use of some special category of senses. It's the same range of senses that we all have. It's the same heart we all have. It's just a little more practice and motivation to talk about those things a bit more openly. However, there are tons of people out there who write poetry in private, who use it for their own purposes, who don't worry about how effective it is. They only write it because they need to, because it satisfies something within them. At some point, if you do that enough, if you take it seriously enough, some of those efforts that might be for your own purposes might actually become interesting to other people.
Well, you know, as poet laureate, I expect that I will have you back throughout some portion of the year, simply because that's quite an honor, and I have to tap that resource. So I look forward to having you back and asking you some of the other deep questions. But we should get on to the meat and potatoes of what it actually means to be the state poet laureate. How does a poet laureate plan his year?
Well, given that the announcement was made today, and I found out this about 10 or 12 days ago myself.
We're talking on Thursday, by the way.
On Thursday, my year is not planned.
Okay.
The rest of my day is planned, if that's a start. But, you know, my primary plan is to get up and try to write something that makes sense or at least expresses something that's inside of me. And if it's no good, if it amounts to nothing, no one will ever see it. That's the great thing about writing poetry. An architectural mistake is very costly.
Yes.
You know, people have to live with it for a century. A poetic mistake is not. You can start over and over and over. And so my primary plan is to get up and write. I think an ongoing life as a writer is part of the responsibility of someone in this position. And the other is quite simple. It's to promote poetry and creativity among all ages, among the people of the state.
Can you envision this honor affecting how you write? The responsibility, does it put more pressure on you to be?
I hadn't thought of that, but now that you mention it, you know,
sorry,
I'm frozen with terror. No, luckily, I'm an early riser. I developed that habit as a rural mail carrier over 10 years. I woke up long before the sun. I was out there. And so even though I've been teaching at the university and the university here for a long time now, I still get up early. And so before any of these thoughts about tasks that might be attributed to the poet laureate come about, I'm just going to be writing. And I don't think it's necessarily going to affect that. I don't think it's going to help. Just because someone has appointed you to an honorary position, it doesn't necessarily make the words flow any better. It doesn't make you any smarter. I'm hoping it doesn't make me any dumber.
Well, even though you are transplanted, we do consider you a Western Wisconsinite. And as such, we're proud of your talent and your accomplishments. And again, congratulations on the honor.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Max Garland. And we certainly cannot allow our new poet laureate and neighbor to leave without first providing an example of his craft. He chose one that fit a sidebar conversation that he and I had prior to turning on the microphones.
We were talking about fathers. My father turned 85 2 days ago, and he was a milkman when he was young. My grandfather was too. The regulations were more lax in those days. You could actually take your kid with you on the milk route. And this is a poem called Early Work. My father's milk truck bounces the county roads, as much a part of the jangle of future as dawn. His shirt is white as God to me. I get to ride along sometimes, The smell of the cooler is the rubbery cold where nothing spoils, where rows of bottles ride like music before the choir wakes up, or the pigeons tear loose from silos and steeples. The cords of muscle in his arms, the pulsing star of cigarette, the jump on the waking world we get as we navigate the deep blue stutter of washboard roads help lift the day onto the calendar. First light arrives, slow as a wage I don't yet know the meaning of, though I feel the glow of usefulness as I lug the empties back to the truck, where the sun has started to brighten the fenders and latches, the chrome of the hubcaps like coins for the road where dark is spent, and wealth is milk at every door.
There you go. Congratulations again to Max Garland. A very good choice, a very good writer, and a very good guy. Places like Amazon.com, the local store in Eau Claire, and others, of course, have access to his books, The Postal Confessions and Hunger Wide as Heaven, and more. Plus, for more information on the Wisconsin Poet Laureate Commission, including how to donate, visit WisconsinAcademy.org. Here's what's on stage this weekend and beyond at Western Wisconsin theater venues. There's A Boy in the Girl's Bathroom, a production of the Eau Claire Children's Theater, plays tonight and Saturday at the Oxford Theater in Eau Claire. A dinner theater production of Guys on Ice will play at 6 p.m. tonight and Saturday at the Heidi Center for the Arts in Chippewa Falls. A show only without dinner will play at 2 p.m. on Sunday. The St. Croix Off-Broadway Dinner Theater production of Guys on Ice ends its run this weekend with shows tonight and Saturday at the theater in Hudson. Mr. Christmas plays tonight, Saturday, and Sunday, and selected weekdays at Fanny Hill Dinner Theater in Eau Claire. The show runs through January 13th. Auditions for the Baron Spotlighters production of Singin' in the Rain are scheduled for 9 a.m. until noon Saturday at the Baron Area Community Center. The Eau Claire Children's Theater is holding auditions for Honk at 5:30 p.m. Sunday and Monday at the Oxford Theater in Eau Claire. Cumberland ETC will be holding auditions for The Music Man, which will be presented June 6 through 9 and 13 through 16, and for a variety show, Cabaret Cumberland, which will be presented January 19th. The audition dates for both shows are Saturday from 9 to 11 a.m. and Tuesday from 6 to 8 p.m. Auditions for Love Rides the Rails or Will the Mail Train Be on Time? The first production of The Wide Spot Players will be held at 7 p.m. Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday at the Wide Spot Performing Arts Center in Stockholm. And that's some of what's happening in live theater around the region. I'm Jim Oliver. Now, you didn't think we were done with Jim Oliver, did you? He's back for another great year of reporting on productions throughout Western Wisconsin, literary works that catch our attention, and, as he likes to say, whatever else we can get him to talk about. Now here's this week's installment of a Spectrum West cocktail with Mr. Oliver.
The Rainmaker is a play written by N. Richard Nash in the early 1950s. It opened in New York in October of 1954, where it ran for 125 performances. It was made into a 1956 movie starring Burt Lancaster and Katharine Hepburn. The story was also made into a Broadway musical, 110 in the Shade. The Phipps Center for the Arts in Hudson will open its production of The Rainmaker next Friday in the Black Box Theater in the Phipps Center. Joining us is the director of the Phipps production, Beth Reidenbach. Welcome to Spectrum West.
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity.
Well, let's start off by just telling us, what is The Rainmaker all about?
The Rainmaker is a story that's set in the Dust Bowl in the 30s of the drought, but really more importantly, it is about bringing hope to a family that really has gone beyond hope. It is more about each of the characters and how their lives have been changed by the introduction of The Rainmaker. A con man who comes to their home and offers to provide them rain based on payment of $100. The promise of rain really develops into a promise of changing their life, which in fact he does.
my recollection of The Rainmaker from, I haven't seen it for a long time, but my recollection is just a tremendous interaction between the characters. And would you just talk about that a little bit?
Sure. The character that I described, the Rainmaker, is a gentleman by the name of Starbuck. That role is being portrayed by Lucas Reidenbach, my son. The Rainmaker comes to this family of three children plus the father. The father lost his wife early on and has therefore been responsible for the upbringing of his children, who are now adults. H.C. Curry is also played by a family member, my husband Jim Reidenbach. And then the three children in the family are the daughter Lizzie, played by Katie McCabe of St. Paul, the son Noah, played by John Nicholas of St. Paul, the third son Jim, played by Tyler Haynes of Hudson. Basically, the situation in the family is that Lizzie is described as plain. She is very forthright and unable, it appears, to find a beau. And so the fear of the family is that she will, in fact, become an old maid, continue to be a burden on the family. And that really is kind of the setup for the Rain Man as he enters their life.
Now, Lizzie, as you kind of indicated, doesn't consider herself a particularly desirable woman until Starbuck comes along. What was it about him that brought her out of her shell for a while, anyway?
The main issue that really creates the interaction between Lizzie and Starbuck, Starbuck being the dreamer, while he is a con man, there is, you know, a portion of his life that really wants to achieve the dreams that he has, whereas Lizzie is very much, it is what it is, I'm a plain person, I can't be who I'm not. So it starts with that conflict, but then it's the sharing of ideas, the fact that Starbuck says it's okay to dream, it's okay to have hope, and don't let yourself be defined by how others see you, that she has to see herself as pretty and believe in her own beauty. So that's really the transformational situation that occurs there.
She is Beth Reidenbach, director of the Phipps Center for the Arts production of The Rainmaker. Well, in your notes, you call the play a romantic comedy. Yet there are some pretty powerful dramatic scenes in the show, aren't there?
Yes, and actually the romantic comedy is how the play is described as you purchase it and in most of the literature. And certainly a comedy in that there are very interesting characters. There is a lot of laughter. It's a very entertaining script. But certainly romantic, the Rainmaker, Starbuck, is able to make Lizzie feel worth and a sense of love and a sense of longing that you see the romance. But in addition, Lizzie does have another male interest, the deputy sheriff, who is, his name is File, and that is played by Keith Johnson of St. Paul. File also has an interest in Lizzie, even though we don't realize that until it develops later on into the script. And there is some nice romantic involvement that develops as the script proceeds. We have File as the deputy sheriff. There also is the sheriff, played by Woody Davidson of River Falls.
Let's talk about you a little bit.
All right.
In reviewing your biographical information, it strikes me that you are the stereotypical community theater lifer. The Rainmaker is the 17th production you've directed, but you've been active at the Phipps for 27 years.
Yes,
wow.
My husband and I moved to Hudson. We both were so happy to discover the Phipps Center for the Arts. We had moved from central Wisconsin, where we had been very involved in a small community theater, and the fact that Hudson had this magnificent facility along with truly wonderful people and volunteers pulled us in right away. And so it was one of our first active participations in an organization when we arrived in Hudson.
Why do you keep on keeping on, I guess, isn't it?
You know, really two reasons. The first reason just being my love of the theater, whether it be directing or appearing on stage or working on props for a show. It just is a very creative atmosphere that I enjoy. the second, but probably even more important, is the people we get to work with, whether it be the volunteers in the shop or the actors who are performing on the stage. Very honestly, my life is truly enriched by, you know, the individuals that I've been able to come in contact with over the last 27 years. So it really is a wonderful, warm community organization to be involved in.
How does one get started in community theater? Let's say that someone's listening and they think, well, that sounds kind of interesting. What do they do to get involved at the FIPS?
If they are interested in just being involved in terms of a volunteer basis, we have a wide variety of opportunities. It can be being an usher for shows. It can be helping in the box office. It can be helping in the shop and doing construction. And the best way to get involved is to actually call the FIPS Center. And that phone number is 715-386-2305. Ask for information on how to be a volunteer. We have a database of people who have expressed different interests. It becomes our job, basically, to reach out to those people and say, we have this production coming up. We'd sure love to have you involved.
Now, how long was it that you were involved in the theater before you started directing, and then what led you into directing?
When we lived in Anago, Wisconsin, which is where we moved from, I had done some directing at that community theater. But arriving in Hudson, I really was involved probably for about 7 years before I actually made the jump to directing the shows. I was stage manager for a number of productions or worked backstage and running crew and so on. And finally, you know, submitted my name as a director with my background and was fortunate enough to be chosen to direct some of the shows. And fortunately, they were well received. And so as a result, I've had many more opportunities.
How is one selected to be a director at the FIPS?
We have a few venues. In my situation, I am working through one of the councils. The FIPS Center has a number of councils. There is a children's theater council that works with the youth in their productions. I work through the drama council, which is the adult theater that does four main stage productions and then special projects over the course of the year. Each year, John Potter, the executive director, advertises for individuals who are interested in directing or serving as other production staff, like a scenic designer or lighting designer, to submit a resume so that they can be under consideration. It goes to a committee, and the committee makes recommendation to the Drama Council of the individuals that they would like to see staff a particular production.
Now, you indicated that the Black Box Theater is where The Rainmaker is being staged. You called that your favorite venue.
The Black Box is exactly as it's named, a square black theater with variable seating arrangements. And so you can take a production into that space, and you can still set it up more like a proscenium stage, or you can set it up as theater in the round. In this case, we are setting it or configuring it more for a thrust of the stage. That ability to really put your audience in the way that you feel might be most meaningful for the particular production is one of the reasons I really like the Black Box. You can actually make the audience feel much more integral to the production itself. The second reason that I like it so well, there is just a very small area even between the person in the last row to those actors. Very intimate portrayal, just ideal for this type of a character show.
Well, we've been visiting with Beth Reidenbach, director of the FIPS Center for the Arts production of The Rainmaker. The show opens next Friday and plays through January 27th in the FIPS Black Box Theater in Hudson. For ticket information, use your favorite internet search engine, find the FIPS, and they'll be right there for you. Beth, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you very much, Jim. I appreciate it.
Support for Wisconsin Public Radio comes from Ken Vance Volkswagen, featuring the new 2013 Volkswagen Jetta with the keyless push-button system, allowing drivers to start and unlock the Jetta without using keys. More at kenvance.com.
Thank you so much for being with us here on Spectrum West on a Friday, the 4th of January. Time is 5:46. Most everyone has an heirloom or several in their home, something the kids can't play with, or a cherished piece of something hiding behind a cupboard door or in a china cabinet. And if we haven't done so yet, I presume we've wondered on more than one occasion what that piece is worth. We know its value to our heart and to our family, but what is it really worth in dollars and cents? Well, that's part of the way Mark Moran comes into the lives of people all over the Midwest. As an antique collectible and fine art appraiser, he's coming for a session to Eau Claire's Ellie Phillips Memorial Public Library. The Iola, Wisconsin resident, has written books on the subject, contributes articles to trade magazines, and is a returning contributor to the popular public TV program Antiques Roadshow. Well, most of us have seen Antiques Roadshow on Wisconsin Public Television, and of course it's a very popular program, and I'm guessing because the descriptions are interesting, and when you get to the point where the value comes out, it's sort of like a game show.
That is a good description. When you're on Antiques Roadshow, as I have been, the producers say, let that moment happen. Once you give them the number at the end, just sort of let it sink in and let them appreciate that moment when, you know, they get the good news. We hope it's good news.
Yeah.
You know, every once in a while they will have a cautionary tale where people, you know, find out that it's not what they think it is. But I think the game show analogy is a good one. And Antiques Roadshow is coming up on its 18th season.
Wow.
The enduring popularity of that program is really a testament to the fact that everyone has something that they wonder about, you know, whether it's a piece that has come down through the family that they've inherited, whether it's something that they received as a gift, whether it's something that they picked up at a flea market or a garage sale. Everyone has something that they wonder about. And that, in turn, has been one of the main reasons why my antique appraisal events have proved to be so popular. A lot of things have changed in the antiques and collectibles and decorative arts markets, and so people just want to know. They just want to know if the story that they heard growing up about Aunt May's vase or, mm-hmm. you know, Uncle Harry's painting, they just want to know if the story's true.
Well, I think the other aspect of all of the people watching as voyeurs is, you know, after they've been told that it's worth $30,000, well, I'm not going to sell it.
Yeah, I hear that so often with family pieces. But you know,
sure.
that sometime down the road, because of circumstances or because of a change in generations of ownership, that piece is going to come back on the market. I hear over and over again, we just don't want the kids to put it out at a garage sale for a buck. Many times they don't care about the value, but they just want to know if the story is true. But every program that I do, I come across an amazing piece.
It appears as if the appraisers on the roadshow, of which you are one, all have some sort of a specialty. Is that common?
Yes, it is. And, you know, in my case, I have usually been on the collectibles table. That means that you'll see, you know, everything from typewriters to advertising to scrapbooks, you name it. I mean, the collectibles umbrella is a pretty big one. But, you know, many of the appraisers on Antiques Roadshow do have a specialty. Of course, Lee and Leslie Kino are known for their expertise in furniture. Mm-hmm. There's my good friend Noel Barrett, who knows all things about toys. There's, you know, David Rago and his wife Suzanne Perot, who do ceramics. And I've worked with them on the ceramics.
You've got that flashy dresser who likes all the advertising stuff.
Yeah. Nick Lowry, yes.
Sure.
Nico,
yeah.
As he's known as. He dresses in those one-of-a-kind suits uh-huh. that, you know, may have doubled at one point as a horse blanket.
Sure.
You never know. But, you know, that's just part of his persona, and it's what people know. And Nico is a great guy. And when it comes to posters, there's no one who has more knowledge.
Yeah, no, you can tell that. And you can also tell that I'm a fan of Antiques Roadshow, well, just by the names I'm dropping.
Yes.
Yeah, well, that's cool. Well, let's go back and find out how Mark Moran got interested in the antique trade. What does it take also to be good at it?
It's a good question. And in my case, it started just about 40 years ago, the first time I walked into an antique shop. At the same time, I also began my previous career as a newspaper man. I worked in newspapers for about 30 years, but I was always involved in antiques on the side. I began as a collector in the 1970s, turned into an antiques dealer in the 1980s, and in the 1990s, I started writing books, and I've written 27 books. And it was from there and the knowledge that I was able to gain that I then translated that knowledge into my antique appraisal events that I do now all over the upper Midwest. So it was a very long process, but you can never do these things alone. And along the way, I made so many great contacts in the antiques trade that even if I didn't have the information, I was able to turn to one of my contacts, one of my colleagues in the trade, to get the answers. It's been a lot of fun, and I'm at the point in my life where I am having more fun than I have ever had talking about antiques and collectibles.
We're talking with Mark Moran, antique, collectible, and fine art appraiser, a regular on the Antiques Roadshow. Plus, he's bringing his appraisal service to the Ellie Phillips Memorial Public Library in Eau Claire on Saturday, January 12th. That gets underway at 10:15 a.m. Mark, is it a must for a person engaged in your trade to have a reverence for what it is you're reviewing, or can a guy like you be successful just considering what it is you're looking at a commodity and you're just slapping on a price tag?
You know, that's a great question. I think many people who have been active as antique dealers for years and years, at some point, the antiques and the collectibles and the decorative arts just turn into merchandise. It just becomes something you buy for X and you try and sell for Y. That never happened to me. I always loved paintings and folk art and Americana and ceramics, glassware, advertising, all these categories. I think that is a great description to treat it with a certain amount of reverence, because if you just treat it as a commodity, you're ignoring all the sentimental value that these pieces have. People often come to me and they give me the story, the backstory of how they acquired something. And I don't think you can minimize the sentimental side of it. And so I always appreciate hearing the story of how the piece came into someone's possession. I never think of it as just an inanimate object that, you know, has a certain amount of monetary value on the market today.
And if you're good at what you do, I'll bet you can see the love in somebody's eyes when they're presenting something to you.
That's absolutely true. And, you know, the other recurring theme that I hear at my programs, especially from senior citizens, well, you know, the kids just aren't interested in these. And I hear that so often, and because there has been such a profound generational shift in the collecting world. People like me who got into antiques in the 1970s watched as collector communities grew up around various categories. All of those collections now are coming back on the market again. Huh. And the prices, in many cases, have declined since they were acquired 30 or 40 years ago. So, again, there has been a really profound shift. I hope that that's changing.
Yeah.
I hope that there will be a time when, you know, wonderful objects, whether it's furniture or glassware or clocks, whatever category, I hope that they will be appreciated again.
The natural progression, you would think, is that the older it gets, the more valuable it gets. However, sadly, I think you have just answered one of the questions that I had for you, which was, how well do you think we're doing at revering and preserving heirlooms? Are we as good as past generations have been, or has the focus now shifted more to what it's worth, and are things just less appreciated than they were at one time? I think we'll all think positively and hope that people do come to appreciate those things. Heirlooms are heirlooms. I mean, they are as much a part of you as the blood running through you, I think.
No, you're absolutely right. And I don't think that we have done, as years have gone by, as good a job of valuing these pieces. Part of the reason for this is that the quality of the reproductions today are so good. If someone just wants a look for their home, and they are not interested mm-hmm. in the origin or the age or the materials or the design influences. They just want something that looks good. They can go to a million places online. They can go to retail stores and find an item that they like, in some cases, for more than they would have to pay for the genuine antique. But it's instant gratification.
Yeah.
They can order it online. They can walk into the store, pick one up, without having to go to all the effort of trying to track something down at an antique shop
mm-hmm.
or a flea market. That's only one of the ways in which the Internet has had such a profound impact on the antiques and collectibles business.
I've heard terms, when you guys are talking to folks on Antiques Roadshow, et cetera.
Yes.
I've heard terms like desirable and trends when referring to an antique. Someone will say, well, they've become much more desirable in the last 5 years. What determines the value of something old?
Oh, boy. It's really comes down to the nature of that item. For instance, in the last decade, modernism has been a very hot collecting category, pieces from the 50s and 60s and even the 1970s. That category has cooled a little bit as different designers, there's kind of a shaking out period where designers rise to the top, and others are considered to be less collectible or less desirable, to use your word.
Uh-huh.
It really comes down to someone, a dealer in many cases, or an auction house, sort of championing a category or a designer or
a
direction.
So those markets can be created, is what you're saying?
Absolutely. Sometimes, as quickly as they heat up, they cool down. But the best pieces will always bring the best money. So if I had one piece of advice for your listeners, is to buy quality. Quality will never go out of style.
You get what you pay for.
Yep.
Interesting guy. Mark Moran. Now, the program is next Saturday, the 12th, at the L.A. Phillips Memorial Public Library in Eau Claire. It begins at 10:15 a.m., and appraisals are by appointment. So if you live in Eau Claire or surrounding areas, stop in. You could probably make an appointment there. Or you can place a phone call to the library at 715-839-4834. Again, 715-839-4834. The program coming to Eau Claire, just one of many Moran does over creation. A full calendar of his events is at his website, markfmoran, MORAN.com. Well, what a fun time I had today. Hope you did too. Thanks for tuning in to Spectrum West. We'll be here again next Friday. Thanks to the always fair Grace Fair for promotional support and to Jim Oliver for his continued commitment to this audio outlet. Stay warm, everybody. I'm Al Ross. Have a great weekend. Go Packers. Yeah, you Vikings guys. Go Packers. And I'll see you next Friday.
Wisconsin Public Radio's Neil Silva Young Artists Competition will be March 24th, 2013, and is open to soloists, duos, trios, quartets, and quintets. Winners will perform in a live statewide broadcast from the Chazen Museum of Art in Madison and will receive an honorarium. For more information, call 1-800-747-7444 or visit our website at WPR.org.
Support for WPR.